Open a Bible to Exodus chapter 23. If you're using the church Bible, that's on page 76. Last week, we looked at the rhythms that God gives to our life. Each day, day and night, each week, the Sabbath, patterns within the year, patterns of years that rhythm our life. They structure our time and orient our lives towards God. But we all know that our lives are not just repeating rhythms year after year. We all have hopes and dreams and expectations. We want to graduate. We want to get a job. We want to go on vacation. We want to retire. We can't wait to get married. We can't wait to have kids. We dream of expanding our farm or our business. We're all looking towards something. We are made to hope and dream and plan and yearn. As Ecclesiastes says, God has put eternity into man's heart, yet so that he cannot find out what God has done from the beginning to the end. Our hearts are restless. And so at the end of this law collection, after giving Israel specific patterns and rhythms for life, God reminds Israel that they are a pilgrim people who are on a journey to a final destination, a journey to a long ago promised land. And God is encouraging Israel to set their hopes and expectations and their desires on the right thing. Here now, as I read Exodus 23, verses 20 through 33. Behold, I send an angel before you to guard you on the way and to bring you to the place that I have prepared. Pay careful attention to his voice and obey his voice. Do not rebel against him, for he will not pardon your transgression, for my name is in him. But if you carefully obey his voice and do all that I say, then I will be an enemy to your enemies and an adversary to your adversaries. When my angel goes before you and brings you to the Amorites and the Hittites and the Perizzites and the Canaanites and the Hivites and the Jebusites, and I blot them out, you shall not bow down to their gods, nor serve them, nor do as they do, but you shall utterly overthrow them and break their pillars in pieces. You shall serve the Lord your God, and he will bless your bread and your water, and I will take sickness away from among you. None shall miscarry or be barren in your land. I will fulfill the number of your days. I will send my terror before you and will throw into confusion all the people against whom you shall come, and I will make all your enemies turn their backs to you. And I will send hornets before you, which shall drive out the Hivites and the Canaanites and the Hittites from before you. I will not drive them out from before you in 1 year, lest the land become desolate and the wild beasts multiply against you. Little by little I will drive them out from before you until you have increased and possessed the land. And I will set your borders from the Red Sea to the Sea of the Philistines, and from the wilderness to the Euphrates. For I will give the inhabitants of the land into your hand, and you shall drive them out before you. You shall make no covenant with them and their gods. They shall not dwell in your land, lest they make you sin against me. For if you serve their gods, it will surely be a snare to you. This is God's word. This morning I want us to see three reassurances in this passage. God goes with his people, God terrifies his enemies, and God's rest points to the promise behind the promise. The first reassurance in our passage is that God goes with his people. God goes with his people. God's people are a pilgrim people on a journey that have not yet reached the destination, the place that God has prepared for them. And as they go on that journey, God goes with his people. Our passage begins with this promise in verse 20. Behold, I send an angel before you to guard you on the way and to bring you to the place I have prepared. God goes with his people on the way, and God will bring his people into the promised land. Although that isn't quite what verse 20 says, is it? Rather, it says, I send an angel before you. This is the third time in the book of Exodus that we've encountered this angel of the Lord. In Exodus chapter 3, we first met him at the burning bush with Moses. And there we read, the angel of the Lord appeared to Moses in a flame of fire in the midst of the bush, and God called to him out of the bush, saying, Moses, Moses. Then we met the angel a second time in Exodus 14 when Israel is up against the Red Sea and Pharaoh's armies are charging down against them. And it says the angel of the Lord moved from in front of the camp of Israel to behind them and stood behind them, coming between the host of Israel and the host of Egypt. And now God promises that this angel who called Moses from the burning bush, this angel who protected Israel from the armies of Egypt, will go with his people. Who is the angel of the Lord? Well, in both the Hebrew Old Testament and the Greek New Testament, the words for angels simply means messenger, and it can refer to a human messenger. But God also has supernatural messengers, members of God's heavenly court dispatched to do his bidding and to carry his messages. And the angel of the Lord is peculiar. In Exodus 3, the angel appears as the fire, and then God speaks to Moses. Here in Exodus 23, we see a similar overlap. Verse 22, if you carefully obey his voice and do all that I say. Who's talking, the angel or God? When my angel goes before you, I will blot out your enemies. Who's going to war, the angel or God? This peculiar overlap between God and the angel of the Lord runs throughout the Old Testament. The angel of the Lord is a bit like a window. Okay, some windows with stained glass or ornate trim draw attention to themselves. The window itself is something to reflect on. But if you rent the summer vacation house on the beach, and you show up and you go in and all the windows facing towards the water are stained glass, you'd be a bit ticked off, right? When you rent a house on the beach, you don't want to look at stained glass. You want to look through the window to the sea. Okay, and the angel of the Lord is a bit like that. You want to see through the window to the view beyond. And the angel of the Lord, the point isn't to look at the angel of the Lord. It's to see through the angel of the Lord to the view beyond, which is God himself. The angel of the Lord, like the tabernacle and the temple, is a way for God to be physically present with his people. So God says in verse 21, my name is in him. He bears my name. When he goes with you, I am going with you in some sense. The promise that God will send the angel of the Lord is a sign of God's commitment to be present with his people. And we're told in this passage, verse 20, the angel will guard you. Verse 22, he will instruct you. Verse 23, he will guide you. Verses 22 and 27, he will confound all your enemies. And yet this promise that God will go with his people through the angel comes with expectations. Pay careful attention to him and obey his voice. Don't rebel against him, for he will not pardon your transgressions. My name is in him. If you carefully obey his voice, then he will fight against your enemies. It's a little bit, these if statements, what do we make of them? God has unconditionally established a covenant relationship with Israel. In the next chapter, we're going to see God ratify that covenant. How then do we make sense of these various conditions that God places? If you do this, then I will do that. Maybe an analogy will help. Students who are getting ready to apply to colleges, there's all kinds of various conditions for getting into a university. Have this GPA, get that SAT score, all these different conditions. But once you're in the school, you've been accepted, and you start working as a student there, you go to class, and the class also has different conditions. Turn in this paper, take this test, and then you can get this grade. The conditions of the class don't determine whether you're a student. You're a student of the university, and that's why you have to do the different conditions in the specific class. I don't know if this analogy is helping, but Israel is in the covenant because of God's grace. They're members of the school, as it were. But these conditions then are saying there's different outcomes. Because you are my people, this is how you should live. And if you do live this way, here's the outcome, blessings. If you don't live this way, as my people, here's the outcome, discipline. So it is with us. We are graciously brought into a relationship with God through Christ. But that's not the end of the matter. We're told how to live. We're told here's various conditions. As Christians, live this way and things will go well with you. Live this way and your life's going to turn into a mess. That's not to say that our relationship with God is conditional. It's totally unconditional. The conditions have been met by Christ Jesus. And yet, nevertheless, having been brought into God's family, now there's expectations for how we live with the God who goes with his people. One of the main blessings for obedience is that God will fight for Israel in the upcoming battles. And that's the second reassurance in this passage I want you to see. God terrifies his enemies. God terrifies his enemies. We see this in verse 27. I will send my terror before you and will throw into confusion all the people whom you shall come against whom you shall come, and I will make all your enemies turn their back against you. God's terror is connected with this angel of the Lord who will connect Israel. It's not a totally different thing. It's the same reality seen from the other side, from a different perspective. Our kids are fascinated by this claim that a person could swim through a blue whale's veins. Apparently, that's not quite accurate. A human can fit inside a blue whale's heart, but their veins are only 9 inches in diameter, just big enough for a toddler to fit inside of. So maybe the Perez boys could make it through a blue whale's veins. Watching a blue whale breach and splash from an Alaskan cruise boat or a whale-watching ship would be an awesome, wonderful experience. It'd be so cool to see a whale breaching and splashing, and you get splashed by the water and see that massive creature whose heart you could fit inside of. But if you're out swimming in the ocean and a blue whale leaps out of the water and splashes down, you know, 10, 15 feet from you, it would be utterly terrifying. It would be terrifying to see this massive whale, this huge creature, that close to you. And so it is with Israel's God. He promises to go with his people who are called to fear him and to recognize his awesome majesty and wonder and to stand in awe before him in fear. But to his enemies, God's presence is terrifying. Who can stand before him? It's interesting. This passage here is the very first time Israel is told that there is going to be a battle to come. They've heard the promises of a land that God has prepared for them, but now there's a bit more. It's also going to be hard work. There's going to be battles involved to come into this land. But in that very same context, God reassures his people that he will terrify his enemies. If you carefully obey his voice, do all that I say, then I will be an enemy to your enemies and an adversary to your adversaries. I will blot them out. I will send my terror. I will send hornets before you, which will drive them out before you. They shall not dwell in your land, lest they make you sin against me. For if you serve their gods, it will surely be a snare to you. God is sending his pilgrim people into a difficult situation when they have to engage in battle. And yet he reassures his people, I will terrify my enemies. It's reassuring for Israel, but we may find it troubling to hear that God is going to drive some people out of their homeland. Well, verse 33, the very end of our passage, brings us to the central point. God is not trying to establish some kind of ethnostate or engage in genocide or ethnic cleansing of a specific people group. Rather, as Leon Cass puts it, the removal of the Canaanites is the surest way to avoid the dangers of dilution and corruption. We must consider God's long and arduous efforts to establish a beachhead in the world for his way, a righteous and holy way for mankind. The removal of the Canaanites cannot be avoided if the way is to take hold and survive. Driving the Canaanites out of the land needs to be understood in this larger context of God's work of redemption. In order to redeem the world, God needs to establish a beachhead. On D-Day, the Allied forces had to establish a beachhead where the troops could amass. It's a place on the shore where they can land their boats and then get the troops together, and then they can press on inland. And Israel's a bit like that. They need to have the land of Canaan to themselves so they can learn to live God's way free from dilution and corruption. And then from there, God's way is meant to filter out to the world round about. So to establish this beachhead in the world for his way, God identifies a particularly sinful people and drives them out of their land to provide a place for Israel. In this context, Genesis 15 is an interesting counterpoint to our text. Here God says he's going to send his terror against his enemies. In Genesis 15, Abraham falls asleep, and we read, "And behold, terrifying and great darkness fell upon him." It's the same rare word, terror, that's used in Exodus 23 and Genesis 15. And then in the midst of that terror and great darkness, the Lord speaks to Abraham, "Know for certain that your offspring will be sojourners in a land that is not theirs, and will be servants there. And they will be afflicted for 400 years, but I will bring judgment on the nation that they serve. And afterwards, they shall come back here in the fourth generation, for the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet complete." God tells Abraham that your people are going to be a pilgrim people. They're going to be sojourners for 400 years, allowing those who live in the land an opportunity to reform their ways before God drives them out. But notice God himself experiences the terror that God sends on his enemies. He experiences the terror of God's presence. But then if we keep reading in Genesis 15, God binds himself to Abraham by a covenant and teaches Abraham to walk in his ways and to fear him. So God brings him into relationship. So now no longer is it experienced as terror, but as healthy fear, the right relationship with the Lord. Now in Exodus 23, the emphasis is entirely on the break with the sinful inhabitants of the land. Don't bow down to their gods. Cut them off. Overthrow them. Break their pillars in pieces. Don't make a covenant with them or with their gods, lest they make you sin against me. If you serve their gods, it will surely be a snare to you. Now that last warning, if Israel turns against God, they might fall under his terror as well. Because Israel is called to drive out the Canaanites, or rather because God drives out the Canaanites to establish a beachhead in the world for his way, that means that the various conquest commands that we find in the Bible are limited to a very particular point in history. At this one point, God is driving these people out to establish this land, this beachhead. But the underlying principle continues to apply to God's people through all ages. We too must ruthlessly cut off false gods and temptation to sin from our lives. Just like God says, don't tolerate any of it. Destroy the idols. Push over the altars. Smash the false gods. So we are called to cut off from our lives false gods and temptation to sin. But then verse 29 and 30 give us a picture of this process. In the life of the Christian, through Christ, God has broken the power of sin over the lives of his people. But then it is little by little, over a long period of time, that God drives the actual sin out of our lives. God breaks the power of, let's say, alcohol, lust, whatever you're struggling with. It's defeated through Christ, and yet the actual living into that victory, it's driven out little by little over time. In fact, over a lifetime, God shapes us. And so we should hear in this passage the call to make a firm break, to cut off things that are temptation in our life. We should also hear the reassurance that God goes with his people, that he battles with us little by little over time, purifying our lives. The third reassurance in our passage is this: I will bring you to the place that I have prepared for you. I'm going to go with you. I'm going to terrify your enemies. And I will bring you to the place I have prepared for you. But this reassurance points to an even deeper hope. God's rest points to the promise behind the promise. God's rest points to the promise behind the promise. What do I mean by that? God promises to bring his people into the place that he has prepared. But if you look at verse 31, it says, I will set your borders from the Red Sea to the Sea of the Philistines, from the wilderness to the Euphrates. For I will give the inhabitants of the land into your hand, and you shall drive them out before you. I don't know how good your geography is, but in my sixth grade classroom, the timeout chair was right in front of the world map, so my geography is really sharp. Saying the Red Sea, that's saying all the way down in the territory of Egypt, and the Euphrates River is all the way up in the area of Assyria, Babylon. So it's saying the entire Middle East is going to be the promised land. And yet, if you read Israel's story, you know that that whole area is many, many times larger than the land Israel ever actually possessed. The promise is simply too good to be true. Even at the height of Israel's power under Solomon, they never got even close to this kind of possession of the land. And then look with me at these promises of blessing in verses 25 and 26. God promises to provide for Israel's daily life and family continuity from generation to generation. You shall serve the Lord your God, and he will bless your bread and your water. And I will take sickness away from among you. None shall miscarry or be barren in your land. I will fulfill the number of your days. What do we make of this? Since I've written this, I've heard about three people from our church going to the hospital. We have people in our church with pneumonia, bronchitis, cancer. Have they failed to serve the Lord our God? Is it because we as his people have not been faithful that that's why we're sick? What of this promise? None shall miscarry or be barren in your land. These are such private things that we feel like we're often alone if we've experienced these. And yet the truth is that many in our church have struggled with fertility or suffered miscarriages. And then you come to church and well-meaning saints ask you things like, when are you going to start a family? Or your little toddler needs a sibling to play with. Of course, they mean well, but it's like rubbing salt into an open wound. It's right where we're most emotionally raw, our deepest sorrows and longings. And so what in the world is God doing here in Exodus 23, 26? Is this just one of these insensitive throwaway lines? God's just making this promise that he's never going to fulfill, that no one's going to be sick, that no one's going to be barren, that no one's ever going to miscarry? No. God's promised rest points to the promise behind the promise. God is saying to his people, I know your deepest sorrows and longing and pain and the hurts that even the other people in the pew don't know about. I know your dashed hopes and your tearful nights, and I will be your God and you will be my people, and I will comfort your sorrows and I will give you rest. Not just external rest in the land, but eternal rest. Your hearts are restless until they find me. And so God's rest in the place he has prepared points to the promise behind the promise. Isaiah sees this. God promises unbelievably wide borders to Israel's land. And Isaiah looks ahead to a day when the mountain of the house of the Lord shall be established as the highest of the mountains. And all the nations shall flow to it. And many people shall come and say, come, let us go up the mountain to the house of the Lord, that he may teach us his ways and we may walk in his paths. Isaiah sees a day when the beachhead for God's way will become the capital of the world, and all the nations will come and say, let us learn this way. And then right after the famous servant psalm or song in Isaiah 53, we read these words, sing, O barren one who did not bear, break forth in singing and cry aloud, you who have not been in labor. For the children of the desolate one will be more than the children of her who is married. You will spread abroad to the right and to the left, and your offspring will possess the nations and will people the desolate cities. Fear not, for you will not be ashamed. Be not confounded, for you will not be disgraced, for you will forget the shame of your youth, and the reproach of your widowhood you will remember no more. For your Maker is your husband. The Lord of hosts is his name, and the Holy One of Israel is your Redeemer. The God of the whole earth he is called. In the book of Revelation, at the end of the Bible, John also sees the promise behind the promise. He sees a vision of a holy city, the New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, behold, the dwelling place of God is with man. He will dwell with them, and they will be his people, and God himself will be with them as their God. He will wipe away every tear from their eyes, and death shall be no more. Neither shall there be mourning, nor crying, nor pain anymore, for the former things have passed away. Behold, I am making all things new. Do you hear the words of a loving father? I am making all things new. And I myself will comfort you. I will wipe away every single tear from your eyes. In Exodus 23, 20, God promises, I will bring you to the place I have prepared. But that rest points to the promise behind the promise that God will make all things new. that he himself will dwell with us. God knows our deepest sorrow and pain and longing and brokenness, and one day he will bring us to the place he has prepared and wipe away every tear from our eyes, and he himself will dwell with us and be our God. Do you remember that wonderful scene at the end of The Return of the King? Tolkien puts us kind of in the right position to understand this. Samwise wakes after being asleep for several days to see his friend Gandalf, who he thought had been dead for months. And Sam says, "Gandalf, I thought you were dead, but then I thought I was dead myself. Is everything sad going to come untrue? What's happened to the world?" That's the promise behind the promise that God's rest points to. One day, everything sad is going to come untrue. But can we really believe the promise behind the promise? Can we really hope that everything sad one day is going to come untrue? Yes, the God of Israel wills to be present with his people, not just through an angel, but taking on flesh and blood so that he could live a fully human life, to guard and instruct and guide his people, and to confound his enemies. And so God's only Son becomes incarnate, born of the Virgin Mary, with a real body that grew up and got tired and took naps and hungered and feasted and felt joy and laughed with his friends and cried and felt sorrow and pain and bled and died. Christ's scars are the proof that we can trust God's promise behind the promise. On Good Friday, once again, terrible darkness covers the land. But the terror of God doesn't fall on his enemies. It falls on his own beloved Son, nailed to the cross. If the promised land is the beachhead for God's way in the world, the cross is the decisive, climactic battle in God's struggle to make all things new. And so God's own Son bears the terror of God-forsakenness. But then on Easter Sunday, Jesus rises, and the wounds where the nails held him to the wood of the cross are still there for the disciples to see and touch. The wounds become the foundation of their hope. This is what it means for everything sad to come untrue. It doesn't mean that the pain and sorrow of Christ's death never happened. The wounds are still there. But the deeper truth behind the deep sadness is revealed. Christ's wounds become our hope. His sorrow and pain becomes our joy. His God-forsakenness becomes our God embrace. It becomes the cornerstone of our union to God himself. Everything sad becomes untrue. God goes with his people and terrifies his enemies. But the rest, the place that God has prepared for his people, points to the promise behind the promise, that through Jesus' resurrection, one day, in a way too wonderful for us to precisely know how it will work out, one day everything sad will become untrue. God is making all things new. Let us pray together. Gracious Lord, your word brings us to topics we'd rather not talk about in public, that touch on some of our deepest longings and hopes and pain and brokenness and sorrow. And yet you do this so that you can offer us the comfort and joy of your Holy Spirit. Some of us are in the midst of very real sorrow, and we certainly can't deny that that is the case. And yet, in hope, we trust that one day everything sad will become untrue, that you are making all things new. Comfort those who mourn. Encourage those who despair. Give strength to those who battle. But above all, give us the knowledge that you love us and embrace us and hold us tight, that you embrace us just as tightly as you have ever embraced your own beloved Son. Amen.